Right, everyone, welcome. My name is Martin Gilling. I'm the chair of today's session on Thinking Big by Thinking Micro. We've got a special guest today who's on the line from Karachi, Pakistan. So this session will be part Skype, part live presentation here in Melbourne. If the technology fails, my able assistant had to go to school today, but we do have the assistance of the AV team here. Firstly, I'm just going to introduce the first two speakers we have today, Jules Gribble and Eamon Kelly. They will be presenting for approximately 20 to 25 minutes, and then we'll take questions and answers. The questions, if you could speak into the microphone, please, to be heard. We will have to repeat them into the computer so that Eamon can pick them up in Karachi. To introduce our speakers, Jules, firstly, has 25 years worth of actuarial experience and is the director of Enterprise Metrics based in Melbourne. In addition to his established pursuits in professional practice and professional education, he has a long-standing interest in risk, regulation and supervision. Recently, Jules has had the opportunity to undertake an assessment of the insurance supervisor in Pakistan against IAIS Insurance Corp principles as part of a World Bank project to better understand the potential for microinsurance in Pakistan. This work, which was led by Eamon, led to some interesting findings, and it's those findings that will be shared in today's session. Jules is a member of the Council of the IAA and a chair or member of several council committees. In addition to all that boring stuff, which we have to say, he's also a keen social squash player and doesn't mind a glass of red wine. I didn't see you last night at the cocktails. Eamon, joining us from Pakistan today, has 20 years' worth of experience in the private insurance sector and consulting in Ireland and Australia. In recent years, he's been applying this experience to the microinsurance sector in particular, working as a program manager and consultant in various microinsurance initiatives in South Asia, the Middle East, and Latin America. He has extensive field and program implementation experience and has directly managed startup microinsurance programs in both India and Jordan. He's also co-authored various research papers and publications and collaborated the building of microinsurance providers. Currently working as a consultant with the World Bank in developing microinsurance framework and regulations in Pakistan. And I'll turn it over to you, Eamon.
As a background, much of the client value and business case analysis is based on studies completed by the Microinsurance Innovation Facility, based in the ILO. And we can provide links to them if you're interested. And I was a co-author on the client value paper. And the rest of the presentation is based on our experience of over 4 years in this sector in emerging and developing insurance markets. There's a significant caveat. There is no perfect answer in this sector, and many are making mistakes and still learning. So it's really, really a very interesting space to be in, and it'll keep developing. And next couple of years, it'll just keep growing, and more interesting practices will be emerging. So what is microinsurance? So hopefully you can see on the screen a definition of microinsurance. So the key thing is that this is, in a sense, microinsurance, you think it's insurance, but it's insurance for a very specific market, a very particular segment. And it's about protecting low-income households against perils for insurance. But the key thing is that we're talking about low-income households. These are people who face very, very significant risks, and insurance can be a really, really powerful tool in helping them deal with those risks. The definition explicitly indicates that such insurance shall be funded by premiums and run with accepted insurance principles, which we all know as actuaries would be fairly make sense. But it's a very, very important thing to specify. It excludes social welfare programs and emerging assistance by governments. However, it can include providers of insurance other than insurance companies or microfinance organizations, such as the government, commercial entities, and so on. And as I said earlier, it's targeted at people who are outside the mainstream insurance sector, often the informal sector, such as in these emerging markets in India and Pakistan and Bangladesh. These are people who wouldn't normally get any kind of insurance cover, but they are facing major red life risks. Now, these are generally very small ticket products, but there is very, very significant scale. So the business case side that I'll talk about later on, the key thing is working on very, very tight margins, but running on a very high dollar scale. And they use very, very varied distribution channels, such as self-help groups, microfinance organizations, cooperatives, and so on. The total potential market that people believe at the moment is approximately 3 billion, so almost half of the world's population. And the current market is estimated to be approximately 500 million insured. But this has changed in the last 5 years. This has gone from 100 million to 500 million in the space of 5 years, and it's still growing. But even still, that 500 million, these are very limited products, typically credit-related products, because most of microinsurance developed along with microfinance. So we need to be clear on the difference between microfinance and microinsurance. Microfinance is providing small loans to low-income people, whereas microinsurance is providing insurance to these people. So a lot of microinsurance developed along with the development of microfinance. And that's why a lot of the current microinsurance products are typically credit insurance products, which are generally very low value products. But the key aspect of it is really around implementation. It's still insurance, but not as we typically know it.
Oh. No, yes, we have, but not for the right reason. You can keep going.
I can't. Is the connection working?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, Okay, which slide are we on now?
What is the next one? What is microinsurance key factors?
Okay. So as I said, these are low-income people living in risky environments who are generally more vulnerable to the perils that we all face, but they're more vulnerable than most people would be. And they're less able to deal with these because of their low savings. They might not have any savings at all. So the products and the insurance is micro from this perspective of the insurer, but not from the end user. Key thing with microinsurance is thinking about the end user, what they're facing, the risk they're facing. And typically when they're low-income people, their vulnerability to risks and the poverty that they are in, they reinforce each other. So when they face a substantial loss, the impact is very, very significant. And often they're using informal means to manage these risks, but these are usually very, very low value or low protection for them. So talking about the difference between conventional insurance and microinsurance, there are a number of aspects to consider, and we've shown the four major aspects. As I said, the client base is quite different. High risk exposure, low insurance culture, very low insurance awareness. The distribution channel for micro is typically through non-traditional approaches. There is some innovation, but it's generally low-tech. Innovation is typically around using mobile apps, because even though these are low-income households in countries like India and so on, the mobile penetration is very high. So there are a lot of interesting products being developed and ongoing in using mobile phone technology. Another really, really tough area, this is where actuaries really have a key role, is around premium calculation product design. Because these are new markets, there is very little historical data to work from. And the underwriting is generally more around the group underwriting. So much different to individual risk pricing that we see in Australia. And it's a very, very price-sensitive market. So the margins have to be really, really fine. And that's why you need large scale. And often the premium payments have to be matched towards people's cash flows, such as every 6 months or in time with the harvest or other means. So that's really important that we, with microinsurance, that is tailored around people's needs and how they can pay the premiums. And finally, and not last but not least, claims process. Often in these emerging markets and developing countries, the claims processing is really, really poor for conventional business. Can take 2 to 3 months. And this is a really, really a major aspect of microinsurance is that we have the claims process as fast and simple as possible. Very limited paperwork, low processing requirements, and really, really speedy. So I realize I'm using a lot of time, so I'll keep moving as fast as I can. So the next one, which shows the pyramid, this is the typical spread of the sort of potential insurance market, and in Australia it'll be quite a different shape, but it's the typical shape in emerging markets. So you see the bottom part of the pyramid where people who are not insurable at all through market means, this is where government schemes come in, and then at the top end, you have the standard insurance, people who can pay for insurance themselves, their own corporate plans or individual plans. Then you have the underinsured, and the middle chunk is the microinsurance market, which is the very significant potential. And often these countries, that market could be like 50-60% of the population. And we're talking about a population of 1.1 billion in India, 180 million in Bangladesh, 180 million in Pakistan. So these are big numbers. So next, I will talk about client value. So I'm on slide 10. So client value, there are, as I said earlier, there was a study completed by the ILO on client value. This is an important area in microinsurance. There's two key areas really at the moment. It's client value and the business case of microinsurance. And certainly for microinsurance, the idea of client value is a challenge, but it's ultimately, to make this work on a long-term sustainable scale, we need to have products that have some client value and there's a business case insurance provider, so there's a win-win situation. So in considering client value, there's typically four aspects that we look at when we're trying to assess client value: how do the products meet clients' needs versus in relation to alternatives that they would use, what are the factors that influence the choices of these low-income households for the demand side, how's the product used, is there loyalty, is there renewals, and so on. And finally, what is the impact of this insurance product? Does it improve their risk management approaches and reduce the vulnerability of those households? So I'll talk briefly on the next slide about a tool that we have developed called the PACE tool, which is really looking at the third aspect of the spectrum of client value. And this is looking at four key aspects of client value: product access, cost, and experience. And within each of those four, we have four sub-dimensions. So hopefully these sort of make sense when you look at that. If we just sit on that slide for a second. The product is describing how appropriate the product is, reviewing the coverage, the benefit level, the eligibility criteria, and the availability of add-on services. Access is looking at accessibility, simplicity, as around the enrollment, what information is provided, is there client education, how is the premium collected, and how close are the services to the insureds. Cost looks at the affordability, value for money, while also looking at additional costs and efforts to keep down the overall cost of delivery. And last but not least is experience. This looks at the responsiveness and simplicity by looking at claims procedures, processing time, policy administration, product tangibility, and customer care. So this is, in a sense, a very important tool for a microinsurance provider to consider when they're developing a product and when they're reviewing a product. They might tick off the boxes for a product that might be very great, they have a great product, but the access is poor, the cost is very high, and the experience, they don't even look at the experience aspect. So ideally, these four dimensions are balanced out, and they all work together. So moving to business case. Clearly, for microinsurance to work, there has to be a business case for the insurance provider. So they have to cover their costs and make a return on their capital. So there was a study completed by the Innovation Facility, Microinsurance Innovation Facility, based at the ILO in Geneva. And that looked at a number of organizations that have had a number of programs running for the last at least 5 years, so they've got a certain amount of experience, and looked at what are the key drivers of those programs what is the business case of those programs, and is there a business case? And this, as I said before, it is insurance, so the profitability drivers are typical for insurance, for microinsurance, but those fundamental differences we discussed earlier, they are still very important. The difference between conventional and microinsurance, they still remain. So looking at slide 13.
Yep.
So the key drivers, I mean, this is not rocket science. We're talking about scale, claims costs, and acquisition costs. So these are not startling. But the key thing is the context is very different. The scale for microinsurance to make it work has to be very significant. And there is very significant potential scale. So you have very tight margins, but you need large scale. Claims costs have to be managed very, very carefully. So this is where you have controls around adverse selection, moral hazard, fraud, and so on, but not excessive controls. Simple, practical controls. And obviously, covering your costs. And then finally, there would be a return on capital action. So as I discussed earlier, the potential market, approximately the 1.5 to 3 billion, is that what's generally being considered. Approximately more than half a billion has microinsurance, and so the unmet demand is between one and two and a half billion people, which is very significant numbers. And even the half billion that we say has current supply, most of that is credit life and some agricultural. But the most common need that people face is around health to microinsurance, which has the lowest penetrations to date. Moving to my second last slide.
Ready?
Get this. Yeah. Okay, so I have an example from India. So given this is an actuarial presentation, I would want to show some numbers. So just to really explain those numbers briefly, there's two schemes we're discussing, and we're showing them over the last 3-year period from 2007 to 2009. The first one is a group health insurance program run in community areas in Western India. This is a group health program. But if we just look at the bottom line number, the gross profit, so that was unprofitable. It's been unprofitable for 3 years and consistently unprofitable. And mainly because of adverse selection. The product was very, very well designed around the needs of the people, but there was very poor controls around the adverse selection. And the provider wasn't able to really diversify the risk appropriately. The second program is the weather-based index insurance program, which is, in India, there's a very, very large scale in terms of weather index insurance, covering crop insurance, livestock, and so on. So this program was distributed through microfinance institutions, the banks, and other credit providers. And it's typically, these type of products are typically along bundled with the loan. And so the first year was unprofitable, the second year it became profitable and continues to be profitable, which is what we all want. But two or three key points to make on this weather index insurance program. There was an increase in the premium in the second year. There is a heavy government subsidy in this program. The positive side was they did reach a very significant scale. And also the index, there were some technical changes in how the index was calculated. Just to make another quick point on those numbers, so if we look at the fourth or fifth line from the bottom of the table, we see the premium levels. So for the index insurance, we can see that after 3 years, it was $20 million was the premium. And that was 3 years ago, so it's probably more like $40 million now. So these could be big numbers we're talking about. And my last slide is just showing the risk diversification within India. So this is India is a very, very large country with over 1 billion people, but you can actually diversify the risk within the country for these types of products. So the index insurance is running in different states, and that was a means to actually diversify across the whole region. So hopefully that was giving you a taste of microinsurance, the client value questions and business case, and hopefully we'll have time at the end where I can answer some of your questions. I'll now hand over to Jules, who will discuss regulation and so on. Thanks, Jules.
Thanks, Ian. I'll just make a few comments here. There's some observations here about policy, regulation, and all that stuff, but I'll skip through them. The rationale background here is that Ian and I got together. We were in Pakistan in late last year, and the World Bank project that we did requires that, well, the object of that program was to decide whether microinsurance is viable or not in Pakistan. In order to do that, you need to understand the environment you're working in. One of the key components of the environment is the regulatory system. So the bit I did was went off and reviewed the regulator in Pakistan, which is the SECP, Securities and something or other Commission of Pakistan, Exchange something, I think. Anyway, the SECP. And we reviewed those guys against the IAIS core principles. So that what happens is there's a general review to get a state of play. So the IAIS is the International Association of Insurance Supervisors. They have a set of core principles. They're the
insurance analogy of the BIS, in effect, right? And they have this set of core principles, and you go off and give people ticks and crosses against them, and away you go. And there's a lot of them, which is really the key point. It covers life and general insurance without much distinction. They do have in place this thing called a principle of proportionality, which in theory says if you're little and simple, we have a little and simple assessment. I'm not sure about the reality of that, to be honest. And what that then gives is a context within which you can develop micro-insurance regulations, which sort of sit on top of the standard set of regulations. So you need a starting point. And as Eamon's pointed out, there are lots of different special characteristics for micro-insurance, so you need to address them. And particular areas you need to focus on in the context of looking at micro-insurance regulation are definitions, allowable products, allowable intermediaries, allowable risk takers, who can do it and who can't, and what's currently happening, the current informal risk takers. Informal here doesn't mean undressed, it means not in the standard, you know, sort of salaried system. Okay, so in countries like Pakistan and India, the informal sector is the biggest sector. Okay, just for those who aren't familiar. And then we look at things like client protection and disclosure and process. Because remember, the people who are going to use these products are vulnerable in lots of ways. They have little education, they're open to exploitation, they're much more vulnerable, so you've got to protect them that much more. So whilst there's all sorts of useful things from an actuarial point of view that you can do, when you look at the micro-insurance change, the big difficult bits, as Eamon said, are around implementation and around consumer protection and making sure that they aren't and can't be abused. Because if you lose the credibility, then the whole thing comes crashing down. So in that sense, it can be quite fragile. So when you develop the regulations, you have the opportunity from the regulatory point of view, it's one of the few times when you have it, where the regulator is actually able to potentially shape a market. And they can either get it right or they can get it wrong. So there's a significant challenge from the regulatory perspective to set up the regulations so they explicitly support micro-insurance things, they explicitly address important issues like management of agents. Agents in a traditional sense sell single policies to single people. Right? In a micro-insurance sense, it tends not to work because it's just not got enough volume in it. But you need to be able to manage those agents. So the setting up, the understanding of where we are and the setting up of the micro-insurance regulations actually is really important key role the regulator gets to play. So this is one of the few times they get to lead as opposed to be seen as following. So a couple of the learnings coming out of doing this, and I have to say this is more Eamon's experience than mine, but alternative distribution mechanisms. Everybody in Pakistan has a mobile phone. You know, and I did some work after this in Papua New Guinea. Everybody in Papua New Guinea has a mobile phone. And it's revolutionary stuff for how it changes how they live and how they communicate and what they do. It's stunning. And forget about kids here with two mobile phones. You have to start avoiding to apply the traditional approaches. You have to unlearn all your experience, go right back to the core principles and start again. Otherwise, you're just trying putting square pegs in round holes. There's challenges to voluntary products. This is the single products. It's just not big enough volume. So you're looking for new ways to achieve the same ends. And it's hard to build sustainable volumes. Eamon said, low margins, large volume. So you've got to get there somehow. Couple of things here, I'll skip that one for a second. So the role for actuaries. What can actuaries do? Well, of course, it's an actuarial convention, so we can do anything we like and everything. But the real answer is actuaries can do a lot. We have, from our training, a holistic view. This is important because from a micro-insurance point of view, the whole process will break down wherever the weakest link in the chain is. And that chain goes from the policyholder all the way through the insurance company intermediaries and back to the claim. Wherever that weakest link is, that's where you want to manage the break. So a holistic view is valuable. And actuaries generally have a capacity to synthesise complicated stuff. In other words, we can see the wood for the trees. And somewhat surprisingly, you know, debates that we had in places like Pakistan and so on, that's a really valuable skill. What's important and what's not. We have technical expertise. necessary but not sufficient for success, but you know, it's useful to have it. You need to be able to be part of a team of experts and specialists. So one of the things you have to do as an actuary is de-god yourself. All right? We tend to have a view that we can solve any problem, and sometimes we can, but we can't do it quick enough. So you need to be a real genuine team player. And actuaries are generally held in these countries with wide respect. So that's useful, but don't blow it. So key tricks: listen and learn. This is about context, as Eamon said. Lateral solutions. You've got to be pragmatic. Okay, so one or two key things that count. The rest don't. And you need simple solutions and simple products. I might make the point that a simple solution and a simple product doesn't mean the analysis and the background work is simple. It just means at the end of the day, from the user point of view, it looks simple. So the challenge, as we said here, is for actuaries to apply complex skills to achieve simple and robust solutions for the insured, not for anybody else. Okay, so there's a big challenge in that, as I think Eamon's amply demonstrated. So I'll just finish here with the last slide, which has on it a picture. CV is client value, okay, which is up and down the vertical axis, and BC is the business case across the horizontal axis. Obviously, where you would like to be is in the upper right-hand corner, where the business case wins and the client wins. And the honest answer at the moment is there are very few microinsurance programs that achieve both of those. There are lots of them that achieve low business case and low client value for a variety of reasons, many of them to do with interpretation. There are a number that achieve low client value and high business case value, which is unsustainable. And there are also a number that achieve low business case value and high client value, which is equally unsustainable. But there is movement, as you can see from the red arrows. So, yes, there's lots of things happening. No, very few people have got it right. Yes, there's lots of opportunities to do this and to do it well, but it has to be done in context and with a lot of sympathy. So I think perhaps I might finish there. Sorry to scoot through it, but I think it's more useful to give you a chance to ask some questions than to bore you with going through that stuff in my opinion. Slides are in the pack, so you can have a look at them a bit later, but hopefully that gives you a flavour of some of that infrastructure that needs to sit around the microinsurance. So I think we're up for questions.
Rod Berry, Eamon. G'day, good to see you. Thanks for joining us from there. Just a question about the regulation. Is this a case similar to the science of, biotechnology, et cetera, of the insurance sort of being ahead of the regulator? And these programs presumably started up before the regulator or any regulators either could or needed to give it much attention. So I guess just a comment on how the regulator, I think, Jules, you alluded that they're trying to be as sensitive to the process. How are they catching up? Are they working in sync? That sort of thing.
So even the question is in general, is the regulation running behind the product development or not? And if it is, how are they catching up? Do you want to have some comments on that?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's very true. Most markets, the regulator is catching up to. There is microinsurance in place in an informed setting. The microinsurer is directly involved. There are a lot of informal programs, community-based programs. Microcredit organizations might be doing insurance themselves with insurers. And I know of many cases that have come across in Pakistan. So the regulator is coming in often. At a market where it's at a very tricky point, where there's informal programs in place and you don't want to disturb and destroy those because they've got to a certain point and they're meeting some kind of a need and a demand. But then you want to help transition them towards a more formal structure. And then secondly, to help grow the market, bring the other suppliers in, the other conventional insurers into the market. So it's a tricky balance, and that's what most regulation tries to address both saying who can do microinsurance and also allowance for transition.
Yeah, so in general, the regulation's trailing. The other point about the regulation trailing is that there are certain aspects of microinsurance that need special care and special attention, and sometimes the regulations that are there are either silent on things, which isn't helpful if you want to put out regulations. Other times they actually impede things unintentionally because they're coming from the wrong viewpoint. So there is this exercise of reviewing where you are, making the changes to support both picking up the existing informal microinsurance providers and also trying to give the industry the opportunity to be able to go forward. So it's a difficult trade-off. And I guess the other aspect is that there's a significant capacity building exercise that sits in the background here, both for the regulators and for the insurance industry. Most of them don't have much experience with microinsurance either, because it's typically evolved outside of the insurance domain as credit insurance, as a bolt-on to microfinance loans, which tends to come under the banking regulator. There's actually a catching exercise to be done as well as a capacity exercise.
Martin Gelling, RGA. I have one quick question. These are for-profit organisations. The two examples that were provided didn't seem to be producing much in the way of profits. Are they typical of the current state of microinsurance? And part of that question would be, what sort of capital environment? Is it economic capital? Is it regulatory capital? Do these organisations operate in?
Question, Ian, is, wasn't a lot of profit in sight for the two examples, but presumably the context is a with-profit context. And following up on that, what are the sort of typical capital rules that come into play so that the with-profit organisations have got a fair chance?
Well, the capital rules are typically not risk-based capital. It's usually a risk-based approach, and there might be some solvency calculated, but it's not anywhere near as advanced as APRA or Solvency II. These would be insurers working under normal conventional capital requirements, which you might have seen in Australia maybe 20 years ago. But ultimately, the profit, the insurers have to make money on these, they have to cover the cost and do make a profit. But a lot of the insurance products are actually one-year products, they're short-term. There is some life microinsurance long-term programs, like 10-year savings. I know of a case in Bangladesh where there's 2 million clients. But typically, most of the time it's 1 year, because it's linked to credit, so it's a one-year time frame. So that's why the margins can be really, really tight, so you need really, really big scale. But often a program, it takes about maybe 2 to 3 years before it really starts to turn around, and then you can really start to make sense from business case side. So it will require an investment of time and effort and some money.
One of the issues around capital and stuff is that insurance companies typically have capital requirements. They might be quite blunt and by formula in these countries, but they're still there. One of the difficulties of bringing some of the informal microinsurance providers in under the insurance banner for, you know, proper prudential regulation is actually means it makes it harder for them because they have to have those requirements satisfied. Counterpoint is, of course, when you get some bad economic times, those informal providers fall in a heap. So you have this trade-off about bringing them in, and you also have the issue that the regulatory environments from a capital point of view can be quite blunt. And that doesn't help you. Eamon, question. How long would it take to implement a new program in Pakistan, given that we were there in November, December?
New regulations or a new insurance program?
New insurance program, not new regulations.
Well, right now, an insurance company can do it tomorrow. They can launch a product tomorrow if they want to. There is no requirement for them. For life insurers, they have to submit their products for approval. For non-life insurers, they don't have to submit for approval. But if you want to design a product from scratch and do your client research and so on, 6 to 12 months would be sort of the time frame.
Yeah, so 6 to 12 months from a regulation point of view, Eamon's in the process now of developing with the regulator microinsurance regulations. They potentially could come in the next 3 to 6 months, potentially, or so, you know, if things go quickly.
Yeah, hopefully by the end of the year. Yeah.
An approval process. However, in Pakistan, if you want to change the law as opposed to produce a regulation, that's a slightly longer process. So the process that's being used here is don't change the law, but change the regulations. But the reality on that is you work with what the local conditions are, and if the means is do it by regulation, then that's how you do it.
Wonderful. That brings us.
Yeah, I'll just add to that. Sorry. Okay.
Quick addition
to that. Like you said, the legislation often does not allow for microinsurance. I mean, in India, for example, the legislation goes back to the 1938 Act when the British were running things. So they don't have any allowance for microinsurance. So often when you're developing regulations, you have to work within a legislative environment that doesn't consider that product to be a type of product. So you have to find innovative ways to sort of bring in regulations that still fit under that legislative structure, but that are more dynamic. So it's a balancing act.
Fantastic, thank you. That brings this session to an end. I'd like to thank both Jules and Eamon for their time, particularly Eamon for making time from Karachi. Thank you.